You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Hello and welcome. It's time again for another edition of the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. New home studios?
Yeah.
Sounds good. Crisp. Nice.
Yeah.
Fancy.
Yeah.
We've got a good show time. Time. Tim. Whatever your name is.
Whatever my name is. Yeah.
New equipment. Same stupid tongue.
Yeah.
The Slender Man Mysteries, Tim. No, it's not a brand new TV show on CBS.
No.
It's not a new documentary series. It's not a new detective series starring Mike Hammer.
No.
No, it's a new book. An internet urban legend comes to life. Nick Redfern is our guest today to discuss his brand new book. Nick is the author of 40 books, including Immortality of the Gods, Weapons of the Gods, Bloodline of the Gods, Monster Files, Memoirs of a Monster Hunter, and so many more. He's been seen on just about every network at one point or another as one of the resident experts. He's here with us and has been a longtime friend of the show to talk to us about the Slender Man mysteries. Nick, welcome back to the show and thank you for being here.
Hey, Dave. Well, thanks for having me on again.
It's always great to visit with you. And this book is interesting, mainly because I found out just when I got a copy of it that I'm in it. So that's pretty exciting.
Yes, you're in it.
I had no clue that I was a part of this mix, but it's good to be in here.
I thought I'd give you a little surprise.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Nick. I mean, I don't care for the fact that Allison trying to pin the whole attack on me, but, you know, other than that, it's a good...
Well, I don't think she was quite saying that. I think it was more... She was just saying that.
We'll get into that. I don't want to give too many spoilers away yet. But let's get into this. The Slender Man Mysteries. Now, a lot of people are fascinated by this. It's been in the news off and on since this horrible attack in Wisconsin that took place, and what was it, 3-4 years ago almost?
Yeah, it was 2014.
Yeah. Wow, time is going by quickly. Let's start people off at the beginning. Give us some background on Slender Man and his beginnings.
Well, basically, it started out as sort of like an internet meme, so to speak. And this was in the summer of 2009. And it began with the Something Awful website, as it's known. And they have these, not so much competitions, but, you know, challenges, who can come up with, you know, this or that. And one of the ideas that they put out there was who could come up with the creepiest character, if you like, fictional character for the internet era. And various people, you know, put together pictures and stories and submitted them. But the one that really got people's attention came from a guy named Eric Knudsen. And he used the pseudonym of Victor Surge. And what he did, he uploaded to the Something Awful website forum a couple of like doctored photographs where there was like a bunch of kids in a park and walking along. And in the background, you could see this tall, skinny, figure in sort of a black suit, white shirt, black tie, and a faceless face. No eyes, no nose, no mouth, just like this faceless head. And it really captured people's attention. Now, it's important to know this. It wasn't like, Knudsen was faking anything. It wasn't like an attempt to pass off fiction as fact. It genuinely was just a competition, an idea to see who could come up with the creepiest creature. That's really all it began as. But what happened was that quite literally within less than about a week, 10 days, the Slender Man pretty much became like a phenomenon. There was this ongoing series you could watch on YouTube called Marble Hornets, which was based around the Slender Man phenomenon. Blogs were set up, forums, you name it. And it went within some a week to 10 days from being just an alternative kind of experiment on the internet to a definitive phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Now, that kind of situation was in place from 2009, as I said, and it went on like that to round about 2010, 2011, when things started to change and people claimed to have seen the Slender Man in the real world rather than just an internet phenomenon. It was as if it had strode out of the internet into the real world. And this sort of gets into the supernatural aspect of the phenomenon. And then, of course, up until that time, probably the only people who knew about it were the many and varied people who followed the story, predominantly kids, teenagers. That all changed in 2014 when two young girls, at the time just 12, in the town of Waukesha, Wisconsin, stabbed and almost fatally killed one of their friends, or friends at the time, I should say. And that really elevated the Slender Man story beyond just being an internet phenomenon to something that the mainstream media picked up on hugely. And so the phenomenon kind of grew and grew from there and then still exists. It hasn't shown any signs of weakening or going away.
Why do you think this character, of all the weird beasties, and listen, there's been the black-eyed kids, there's the raw-head man, there's a bunch of weird creatures that have kind of surfaced over the years, but Slender Man has become so popular. I hate to use that word. I mean, he appears in video games. He's like an Easter egg character in a number of different video games. There's a video game for your phone called Slender that people get addicted to and say it absolutely terrifies them to play the game. Why do you think this guy took off so powerfully?
Well, that's a good question, because I mean it's interesting you bring up the black-eyed children, because that has become sort of a definitive phenomenon as well. But even that has been eclipsed by the Slender Man. I think one thing is just the name, the Slender Man. It kind of has that, I guess, like a tinge of like urban legend, urban folklore attached to it. And most stories along these lines, when it's a strange name and it's an urban legend, it's sort of perceived as being connected to sinister activity, paranormal phenomena, murders, that kind of thing. Everybody's heard the urban legends of the local axe murderer who killed somebody on the bridge. You can find stories like that all around the world. And typically the character in the urban legend is given a particular name, and I think that kind of angle has become part of the reason why the Slender Man took off, just the sheer name, the Slender Man. And then, of course, when you have this figure and sort of 7 to 8 feet tall, spidery skinny limbs and these flickering tentacles coming out of its back, you have sort of all the, and then of course, it lurks in the woods and the forests and pursues children. It has this sort of very disturbing imagery attached to it, which people just move towards it like a magnet. So I think part of it was the timing with the internet and the ease with which today a phenomenon can take off. I mean, when we were kids, you know, this could never have happened because there was no way for the story to spread on such a massive scale. So I think the internet has had a massively significant influence on how the story and the phenomenon has taken off. But
you know what's interesting, though,
itself,
with that point, you said, you know, that there's really no way when we were kids for that to take off. But there were those strange urban legends. There was the urban legend at the, you know, at the mall. And I remember hearing about it when I was growing up. And then I talked to my cousin in Florida and I told him about what happened. And he said, no, that didn't happen in Bloomingdale, you know, Bloomingdale, Illinois. That happened here in Pensacola, Florida. And it was this, you know, woman goes out to her car and she gets in and realizes there's a little old woman sitting next to her. And she gets out and she's like, ma'am, you're in the wrong car. She's like, oh, can you just, I can't find my car. Can you give me a ride home? And she gets real uncomfortable. She leaves, brings security back. Security drags a woman out of the car. Wig falls off. She was sitting on an axe. Turns out that this was a potential serial killer that they were able to drag out of the car. And that story went around the United States. I knew somebody in every state who knew that it happened at their mall. So isn't that interesting that those kind of weird urban legends and stories, even when we were kids back in the Stone Age, Nick, that there was, you know, when messengers were being messages were being sent by pterodactyl instead of the internet, that they were able to share that kind of story and that it had that kind of roots that when you could tell it, people believed that it was from their area, and it went around the world that way.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want people to think, you know, that there wasn't any kind of, you know, ability to share stories back then. I think the big difference with the Slender Man is the speed with which it can happen today, you know, in terms of just instantly, you know, sharing this, sharing that, and before you know it, it is worldwide. And I think just that imagery, you know, sort of the black suit, the white shirt, the black tie, which kind of provokes sort of a, like an authority type imagery, but then again, you know, you have him lurking in the woods, which kind of adds a sinister aspect to it. I think you put everything together, and he created, you know, or it kind of ignited something in a lot of people's minds, and they just became obsessed with it. I mean, literally obsessed. There's really no other way to describe it.
But to my point, the interesting is how these kind of stories have always circulated and how quickly they will spread even. And it was viral back then when there wasn't the kind of contact that there is today. And these stories would still zip around. And it's fascinating to me that that happens. Now, when we started the show, and I think it was one of our very first episodes back in 2006, a friend of my then wife had called in to share her story. And it was that she and her husband were off to a party. And while they were driving, they came to a T, an intersection, and a car came rolling through the intersection, and the driver turned to them, and he had no face. It was a blank. It was just like a skin flap. And he turned and looked at them, and they were like, what the hell did we just see? They took the right and went on to their party. Later that night on their way home, when they got back to that intersection, a car came barreling through and hit them at that T, and they were both almost killed. But it was this blank, faceless man. And then a number of years ago, before Slender Man took off, we had a story from one of our listeners here in Minnesota. I think it was Caribou Coffee. She went in every morning before work, get a cup of coffee. She's standing in line, gets her coffee, walks out to her car, and there's a man in a suit standing there looking in her window. And she stops and she goes, excuse me, can I help you? Are you looking for something? And when he turned to face her, he had no face. It was just that blank skin again. She ends up backing up, going back into Caribou Coffee, where she just kind of stood there stunned for a bit. And the baristas recognized her because she was in every morning. And they're like, what's wrong? And she didn't want to tell them what she just saw. She just said, there's some strange man by my car. So two of the baristas went out with her to make sure that she was okay. Nobody's there. She gets in the car, heads on the way to work, hits this big traffic jam, eventually gets up there to find out there was a big accident. And it had happened around the time she would have been going through that intersection. So here we have two cases where it's this very similar look, this similar character, no face. And in both, it seems like kind of a precursor to something negative coming through. And then all of a sudden, the Slender Man story started to hit. And we were, I think we
well,
were...
Yeah, I mean, Oh, go on, sir.
And I was just going to say, we were doing a live remote, and we had a kid come on from talking to us about the creepypasta sites and about these cases, and Slenderman was a pretty big deal that was just really starting to break at that point. And that was long, again, before the murders or the attempted murders that have subsequently taken place to this character's name. So it is interesting that there have been strange versions and iterations of this that kind of predate the explosion that took place. And now, since, it's even gotten more powerful.
Yeah, you're right. And one of the important things about this angle of sort of the Slender Man being seen before, you know, the Slender Man actually existed, is an interesting one. And people say, well, how can it be that people reported seeing the Slender Man before it was actually created? And one of the things a lot of people don't know is that Eric Knudsen, who created the Slender Man, actually used a great deal of, or pulled a great deal of history, etc., from the world of the paranormal to create the creature. For example, by his own admission, he was heavily inspired by things like the Mad Gasser of Mattoon, which the story goes back to the 1930s of this black-suited figure that... that invaded the town of Mattoon and caused all sorts of havoc, breaking into people's homes and causing paralysis, and he would loom over the bed at night. And he also was a big follower of the work of H.P. Lovecraft, and that sort of inspired the sort of tentacle-type appendages, if you like, coming out of the Slender Man's back. And but what's interesting is that there's a school of thought that, which believes that Lovecraft didn't sort of just create his stories and the creatures like Cthulhu and things like that out of his own imagination. They feel that he actually, in the sleep state, had access to different realms of existence and unknowingly created them in that way. So, in other words, Eric Knudsen was using the paranormal rather than just fictional creatures. It was inspired by a great deal of paranormal phenomena in the way he created the Slender Man imagery. And this has led researchers of the Slender Man mystery to suggest that Knudsen wasn't so much creating the Slender Man, but was actually subconsciously pulling on an ancient archetype that has been with us for so long, you know, like the boogeyman. And that may go some way to explaining how and why people have seen the Slender Man before its official release, so to speak.
So he did admit to drawing on the past and information from that. He didn't say that this was just a total creation from his own mind and imagination, then.
Oh, no, he openly admitted he was he was very intrigued by things like the Men in Black mystery, as I said, the Madgaster of Mattoon, Lovecraft's work, and the links with, you know, was it inspired by something in the dream state, you know, opening to a different realm of existence, you know, when you're sleeping. Also, the Mothman mystery, and a bunch of other sort of similar angles. And you put all those together, and you're drawing on things which are not fictional creations of a comic book or something like that, but which are creatures acknowledged within the realm of the supernatural, then that may explain things a little bit further, you know, like I said, in terms of the time frame and when it really did begin, or has it been with us, you know, since who knows when.
And maybe part of the mystery to it as well of why it has taken off, as opposed to, I mean, Black Eyed Kid certainly is a phenomena that we, you know, started to really hit hard on our show probably about 7 years ago. And it has certainly captured the attention of the world, and people are fascinated by it, but they're not as nearly drawn in as the Slender Man case. Maybe because in most cases, it's adults encountering the Black Eyed Kids. And we always have that kind of a little bit of a feeling of safety because we're adults, they're children. And I wonder if the reason Slender Man is more creepy is he kind of falls into that Pennywise category, right? The real danger is to the children, because Slender Man only seems to really show up around these children and kind of stalking them in their natural habitat, right? In their playgrounds and parks and places that kids can get isolated and separated from safety. So the danger issue is heightened And maybe that's why he's considered a more creepy character than even these, you know, weird killer clowns. Clowns are freaky enough to a lot of people, but this is faceless. It's anything that your mind kind of plays upon.
Well, yeah, you're right. And I think you make a good point when you talk about how, you know, the Slender Man targets children. And I think what this has sort of really hit home is the fact that children, obviously, are relating to it because the Slender Man focuses on children, you know, threats to kill them, that kind of thing. And so in that sense, it's like any aspect in life. You know, if you can relate to it, you gravitate towards it. And I think that's what happened. I mean, I'll give you a good example. One of the people I interviewed for the book was the publisher of Paranoia magazine, Olaf Phillips. And he told me how his son, he brought up the issue of the Slender Man with his son, who was like 6 or 7 at the time, and he kind of went quiet and said, well, why are you asking me, Dad? And he finally got around. Olaf found out that his son and all his friends at school were all totally sort of obsessed with the Slender Man, and the actual word that Olaf used was consumed. He said they were consumed by the Slender Man phenomenon, but they didn't want to tell their parents. It was like their little secret because it was connected to them, to children. And I think that, you know, I think you have this sort of under-the-radar aspect of having, who knows, you know, countless numbers of kids following this, and the parents don't know about it, the family doesn't know about it, but all the other kids do, and it's like their little silent secret until, you know, their parents kind of push them, and it starts to come out a bit more then.
When you look at the kind of genesis for this and the reimagining of this creature and the subsequent attacks and weirdness, when he created Victor Serge, you know, his pen name, created this character for the internet, did he give it a full fleshed out background? Is he the one that said that in order to gain favor with Slenderman, you had to kill or you had to do this? Or did that become fan fiction that followed?
Yeah, yes, it did. I mean, Eric Knudsen essentially sort of created the image and added the photographs, which did, you know, immediately associate the Slender Man with children, because the pictures that he uploaded to Something Awful were of the Slender Man in locations like parks and playgrounds where kids were. So that part of the story did come out immediately. But the rest of the story, literally within days of Eric Knudsen's, you know, Slender Man really becoming popular and catching people's attention and imagination, you had numerous other people who then started to write their own fictional stories and scenarios concerning the Slender Man. And they would post them to, you know, various websites. And, you know, you had, as you said earlier, you had Creepypasta, you had the Something Awful website, you had people creating forums and blogs for the Slender Man. Even the Wikipedia page was up in no time.
Hmm.
And what you had were people who expanded and elaborated on the original creation of Eric Knudsen. You know, they included their own stories. And again, it wasn't a case of hoaxing. It was people were putting stories on the internet about how the U.S. government or an arm of U.S. intelligence knew about the Slender Man, and that there were hospital files where, you know, people had seen the Slender Man and gone mad and were put in asylums, and, you know, somebody claimed to have access to the old files. But they were just stories. But at one point, you had like a blurry line where people began to accept that the fictional stories were based on reality. You know, so you had this, it's almost like Gonzo writing that Hunter S. Thompson used to do, where, you know, it's the basics of the story are fact, but then you have this sort of fictionalized attachment to it as well. So the lines become blurred. And a perfect example would be Thompson's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, you know, which is a definitive gonzo fact versus fiction story. But with the big difference between that and The Slender Man is that The Slender Man stories came to be believed as, you know, something real, not just something that was sort of fictionalized. And when you have that blurring of the lines, I think, between what's real and what isn't, then, you know, it's like anything goes. You know, people were just buying it all and just being entertained by it and fixating on it. And then I think is when, you know, when people started to see the Slender Man in the real world, that then gets into the field of what are known as like thought forms and tulpas, the idea of if enough people strongly and obsessively believe in something, even something fictional, that in a strange way you can give birth to it in like a paranormal fashion, so to speak.
All right, now this attack in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Can you explain to me? I mean, there was a lot that came out at that time. And originally, as I recall the story, these girls had decided to take out their friend quite a while before they actually did this and had planned it a few times, but this was the first time that they actually followed through, and that it was to gain favor with Slenderman so that they could get access to his kingdom in, you know, hidden within the forest in like in a spectral realm. Now it seems the story has kind of mutated to the kids were trying to protect their own family and a sacrifice had to be made. So is this just the gameplay of the defense attorneys trying to, you know, show some sympathy for the devil in this case? And hey, they were doing it because they thought, you know, yes, we admit that their minds are messed up and they made bad choices, but they did it trying to protect their own family. What is fact and fiction in this case, Nick? What can you tell us about their inspiration, their reasoning, and what really occurred in this attack?
Well, I mean, this sort of gets to the heart of the Slender Man mystery again, where you have people who, like young children, whose minds become affected by the fact that they're so obsessed with this phenomenon, and they get to a point sometimes when they're not able to distinguish between what is fact and what is fiction and what is somewhere in between. Now, in terms of what actually happened, this was May the 31st, Saturday, 2014. And the day basically began quite normally. You have these two girls, Anissa Weir and Morgan Gazer, and they attacked a friend of theirs, Peyton Lutner, in a nearby park. And everything had been going fine. I mean, the night before, one of the girls actually had a birthday. They had a sleepover. And, you know, they had breakfast all together, which one of the mothers did for them. And it was just like a regular weekend, you know, no school and just hanging out. But it almost immediately mutated when this vicious attack on Peyton Lutner, who thankfully has now made a complete recovery. She's got physically and psychologically, you know, she's fine now. But she was stabbed almost 20 times, and some of the stabbings, you know, came so close to major arteries and organs that it's pretty much almost a miracle that she survived.
Oh no, it's not now, almost a miracle. 20 stabbings and she's still alive. Yeah, that is insane that that they didn't hit something major.
No, you're right. Yeah.
Wow.
And at the time, all the girls were 12 years of age, you know, went to school, they knew each other, were great friends, and yet there was this issue of essentially sort of sacrificing the girl as a means to appease the Slender Man. Now, depending on the time frame, you know, when you see the story and the words that have been said, on the one hand, in the part of the story, you know, it was done to essentially, the Slender Man needed a sacrificial figure so that the girls could become, in their own words, the Slender Man's proxy. But then, as the story got deeper, it was, well, we had to do it to protect our own families, which is kind of like a variation on the other aspect of the story. Now, whether that was because things were changing, or just because the more the police dug into it, more came out. You know, it's hard to say which is the definitive answer. But what I would say, you know, it's clear that the girls themselves fully believed in the existence of the Slender Man and fully believed they had to do what they did. And, you know, again, you have this blurring of fiction versus fact in just about the worst way possible, you know, your worst nightmare possible.
Were they doing it to gain favor with Slender Man so that they can get access? Or were they doing it because they felt that Slender Man would come and kill their family if they did not give this sacrifice? Do you know which story is real according to the actual case?
Both angles, if you like, were presented. And it kind of mutated over time. It did begin when, you know, the story first got out and, you know, there were initial interviews with the girls. It really was because they felt that, you know, the Slender Man wanted, you know, they could achieve like a role as a proxy for the Slender Man. But the more that the police dug into the story and, you know, questioned the girls more, that was when the angle of the fear that they had for their own family. So it was kind of like, it wasn't an either-or thing. It was a development in the revelations coming from the mouths of the girls. So, you know, it's difficult for us to say for sure as to how and why that aspect of the, you know, the interviews, etc., kind of altered a little bit from, you know, the original claim versus how the story developed. But it could, you know, some people have suggested it's a combination of the two. In other words, that they did it, they tried to sacrifice the girl as a means to become the proxy of the Slender Man, but people have suggested that, well, if they felt that they didn't achieve it, then the Slender Man would come after them. So they had to do it. So it could be like a combination of the two. But I think why this case caught the attention of so many people was because it was clear that the girls really did believe that what they were doing had to be done. And I think that had a major bearing on, you know, why they received sentences that will see them, you know, behind closed doors, so to speak, for decades, because this wasn't just, you know, some bizarre game for them. This was reality. And of course, for the rest of us, it isn't reality. And I think that was the reason why they were, you know, they got such long sentences, not just because of the attack, because of the issue of them having blurred reality and fiction and not knowing really which is which can put, you know, a person in that mind frame can be dangerous and was dangerous, as we've seen.
When we return, how does Darkness Dave figure into the synchronicities of this story and the attacks? We'll chat about that and more, but first, it's time to go back into the Dark Hives, and this time, we're face-to-face with Slender Man in Theater of the Mind. It's time now for Theater of the Mind, a real-life encounter from Marco Rivas. Face-to-faceless, a visit from the Slender Man. To say I had been obsessing over Slender Man since it first made its way into the internet would be a bit of an understatement. I read everything I could find. I played the games, watched the YouTube videos, and I immersed myself into the made-up legend of this creepy character. I talked about it constantly to anyone that would listen, and it began to wear very thin with my family especially. The parents have always been very cool about letting us explore our own interests, within reason, and they saw no real harm in me investing so much time reading about Slender Man. In their opinion, it was no worse than reading about a boy wizard and his pals or a Stephen King novel. Things began to get interesting for me when I researched tulpas, thought forms, and that like. I wondered, in morbid curiosity, if I could create a manifestation of Slender Man, even for just a brief moment. With that, I set about learning all I could on the subject, and I was endlessly fascinated with the idea. Could I actually create something that would terrify me? Would my mind even allow that to happen? After weeks of study and procrastination with putting off my ill-fated experiment, I finally decided to give it a try. I did it with my best friend by my side. He was unsure of what he should expect. I think he joined me more hoping I would see how stupid this all was and be there to watch me as I fail so he could finally tell me, enough is enough. We sat in my room, each finding a comfortable position to begin light meditation. My parents were gone for dinner with my uncle, so I knew we had a window of opportunity to try this, and if things were to go poorly, they would be home soon to rescue us or comfort us. I walked my friend through a guided meditation. I spoke about the being that is the thing of my nightmares and began visualizing him, standing at the end of my driveway, a safe distance from my house, under the lamppost, but still close enough to the woods at the end of my cul-de-sac so that it could scurry away into the night if need be. We imagined it, tall and lanky, dark and foreboding, silent and terrifyingly watching my house, and more specifically, my bedroom window, which was situated safely on the second floor of our house, overlooking the front yard. We breathed deeply. And we allowed our minds to stretch outward, inviting this creature into our safe little world. When I felt like we had spent enough time setting our intention and trying desperately to keep my nerves under control, we both stood up and moved slowly to my window. With a slight hesitation, I reached my hand out and I grabbed hold of the curtain and drew it back, revealing a clear view of my darkened front yard. We scanned the yard from left to right and then back again, and there was nothing. It was silent and peaceful. We exchanged a nervous laugh and shrugged our shoulders, resigning ourselves to the fact that this was a failed experiment and I would have to do more research and work to find a way to call forth this imaginary being, if there really was a way to do it. My tummy rumbled and reminded me that, in preparation for our little experiment, we had not eaten dinner. My parents would return soon, so I asked my friend if he would like a frozen pizza. He nodded vigorously in agreement, and we set off down the hall and down the stairs to the waiting kitchen to make our meal. We made small talk for a bit, and then we heard the distinct sound of something lightly tapping on the front window in the living room. The two of us exchanged uneasy glances, and I said, "Hey, can you go see what that is while I check on the pizza?" He just shook his head and whispered, "Hell no. It's your house. You go check." I did my best to regain composure and made my way to the living room with him in close pursuit. Then the tapping came again. Tink, tink, tink. Something was lightly tapping the front window. I tried to look out the small peephole that my front door had to see what was out there, but I couldn't get a clear angle on it to see anything. Tink, tink, tink. The glass tapped again. Now, I'll be honest, it wasn't menacing or with force, but I think that it was what made it even more creepy. Like something playing with us. My buddy piped up, "It's probably just a branch from the bushes outside blowing against the glass." That's what he tried to reassure me in a hushed whisper. "Well, if it's just a branch, then why are you whispering?" I questioned. He just shrugged. The two of us approached the front window, slowly, but with purpose, and prepared ourselves for whatever was creating that sound. The alarm from the kitchen buzzed to alert me that the oven was preheated. We both about leapt out of our skins, and we shared a nervous laugh. We turned to go back to the kitchen and load our pizza into the waiting oven when we heard it again. This time, a bit louder, and with what sounded like multiple things clinking against the glass in unison. Plink, 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 plink. I knew it had to be that damn bush out front, and also knew I had to prove it to myself and my faithful pal who stood by my side. I confidently strode to the front window and with a yank parted the curtains. Every muscle on my body locked up in fear. There, standing at the front window, was this faceless thing. Its arms crossed against its chest like an angry parent calling you out for doing something stupid. From behind its back were long, spidery-like appendages that were spread out and reaching toward the window, and each one taking a turn tapping the glass. Plink, 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 plink. I could hear the whimpering of my friend as he crumbled to the floor. My heart pounded. My chest refused to take a breath. This thing just stood there, gently rapping the glass. Pink, 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 pink. I turned and took off toward the kitchen in hopes of grabbing a large knife to protect myself. I banged into the side of my dad's recliner and knocked it over in my haste to escape. That's when I heard what I can describe as something hitting the roof with force and the sound of running above me. All I could imagine was this thing had climbed up my house with those spidery legs and was now running across my roof to torment me further. I hit the hardwood floor of the kitchen and slipped and slided, trying to right myself and get to the butcher block knife holder. I grabbed the biggest knife I could and I stood there shaking, unwilling to turn and face the exposed windows of the kitchen and dining room. I could not convince myself to look out. Is he still out there? I yelled to my cowering friend.
No! No!
He shrieked no and followed it with light sobs. That's when I saw, in the reflection of the microwave door, something was just outside the window behind me looking in. I was frozen in complete fear when I heard the most amazing words anyone ever spoke in my life blast from the living room.
Your parents are home!
Then I heard the sound of the garage door opening. I stood motionless, clutching the long, deadly knife in my hands. The door from the garage into our dining room swung open, and my parents strode in, carefree and having obviously enjoyed the night out. Until, that is, they got a good look at their wide-eyed son standing frozen in place, clutching the knife to his chest.
What in the hell are you doing?
My father barked. My eyes quickly darted to the reflection in the microwave, and surprisingly, the thing was still looking in the window behind me. I trembled and tried to speak. All that came forward was incoherent whining.
Something out there. Something out there.
My mom let out with a blood-curdling scream as she pointed to the window behind me. My dad, always the former military man, sprinted forward, cutting her off her pathway to the kitchen. I think he thought I was about to attack my mom. Then he cried out,
Jesus Christ, what the hell is that?
My head spun and my father grabbed for the phone and dialed 911 to report an intruder on our property. The thing had taken off across the yard at breakneck speed, making its way to the wooded area that surrounded our neighborhood. We tried to explain to my dad what had gone on that night. He just stood there sternly glaring at us.
You and that goddamn Slender Man, he muttered.
The police arrived and did a short walk around our house, both inside and out, and felt we were safe, but told us that they would be doing a walkthrough of the woods behind the home. They ended up rousting out a few homeless guys from the woods that night, but said they saw nothing else out of the ordinary. Finally, we settled down. My friend demanded to go home, so my father drove him the two blocks home and then returned. I promised never again to play with things I don't understand, and I would leave well enough alone. I agreed and just wanted to put the whole damn thing behind me. Later that night in my room, I texted back and forth with my friend to make sure he was okay. We talked about school, girls, and anything but what had happened. We wanted our minds on something more of this world before we fell asleep. We said our goodbyes, I climbed into bed and reluctantly snapped off my bedside light and rolled over onto my back. That's when I noticed the shape of a man, the shadow streaming in from my bedroom window. I had never drawn the curtains back to a closed position. Something was standing outside my second-story bedroom window. I slowly pulled my covers up over my head and called out for my mother, who came into the room, snapped on the overhead light, and assured me everything was fine. And then she crossed my room, pulled the curtain shut, and said in a forceful and commanding voice I'd never heard her use before, "You are not welcome here. You need to go and leave us alone. My son will not be calling on you again."
Then, like it was a normal night, she turned and said to me in a voice as sweet as sugar, "Good night, honey, sweet dreams." I really don't know what happened that night, but I do know I will never call upon something to test a theory again. I'll leave the experiments to the professionals. I'm a 22-year-old now, and just revisiting this story has made my blood ice over.
Beyond the Darkness.
Our guest today, Nick Redfern, the Slender Man Mysteries, an internet urban legend, comes to life. Now, listen, Nick, I was surprised when I get the book. I'm flipping through it, and lo and behold, there it is on page, I think, 121. There's reference to, I mean, I don't like to brag, but, you know, a pretty popular radio show host.
Yeah.
Who was on Coast to Coast AM and talking about Slender Man. And this is kind of a weird synchronicity. This was the night, I didn't even really realize this until I read this. This interview I did with Bill Murphy was the night before the attack?
That's correct, yeah.
Wow. That is bizarre, isn't it? So here we are talking about this meme and the idea that it could be a tulpa and a thought form, and how does that come about? And if we give this thing attention and focus, is it giving it life? And the next day there's this brutal attack.
That is basically the concept of the tulpa, Dave. For people who aren't aware of what tulpas are, tulpa is a Tibetan term for thought form. And the idea is that the human mind, if enough people focus on something, anything, just, you know, it could be a fictionalized creature or something like the Slender Man, if literally hundreds of thousands of people are fixating and focusing on it, and they have it in their mind, they're obsessing about it, they're reading about it, dreaming about it, that this collective unconscious, if you like, or conscious, however you want to term it, then externalizes the imagery to the point where it's sort of like giving birth to something of a supernatural nature. And in other words, when we dream about it, when we think about it, and we externalize it, it creates a real-world equivalent of the fictional entity. And that's one of the primary theories for how and why the Slender Man began as an internet phenomenon, but is now being seen in the real world. And the whole angle of how and why the tulpa can survive is it's essentially reliant on belief, and sort of the energy of the mind nourishes it, energizes it, and keeps it alive. And so the more we think about it and debate it, the stronger it gets. And of course, people say, well, why don't we all just not think about it? That's not the easiest thing to do. You know, it's like saying to somebody, don't think about a blue elephant. Well, what's the first thing you think of? A blue elephant, you know? And it is incredibly difficult for so many thousands and thousands of people, kids, to turn off that fascination they've got. And so that is basically the concept of what a tulpa is and how it comes into play with the Slender Man.
And the idea of these tulpas, I mean, they have been covering this. And you look at like It, which was a huge movie breakthrough this last year. Right. And it's a remake, of course, of the TV movie from the late 80s. And it's a Stephen King novel. But that's really kind of the whole focus of the movie is the tulpa and the power that it gets from being thought of and feeding off of the fear as an energy. And when that fear is taken away, how it affects the creature and its ability to be powerful. And if that's not an old enough throwback for you, even though the book is, I think, 40 years old at this point, Peter Pan touched on this with Tinkerbell, right? Tinkerbell starts to fail because nobody believes in fairies, so she's dying. It isn't until people clap and cheer and believe in fairies that it gives her back her ability. So in a sense, that whole realm has been discussed and talked about how by giving something attention, that's what gives it life.
Yeah, then you have the opposite angle as well. When, like you said, with, you know, tales of fairies, people don't see fairies anymore, or hardly. Well, maybe that's because people don't believe in fairies. And so what happens then is that tulpa starts to fragment and deconstructs. So it's reliant on having that strength. I mean, a good example that I guess a lot of people either forget or don't realize is the old early 1950s sci-fi movie, The Forbidden Planet, where one of the characters played by Walter Pidgeon, when he goes to sleep at night, he has these nightmares, and he externalizes the imagery of the aliens that once lived on this planet and brings them to life when he's in the dream state. And they're just as dangerous when he creates them inadvertently than the original ones were, that became extinct hundreds of thousands of years earlier.
All right, now this case, and it is weird, like I said, I never realized that I was on the radio talking about Slenderman the night. Was it actually the night before or the night that the attack did take place?
Well, the attack was on May the 31st, but I guess, you know, with the time frame, whether you're West Coast, East Coast, etc., it did spill over into the very early hours of the day of the attack, yeah.
Are there other strange synchronicities kind of attached to these Slenderman attacks and Slenderman storylines?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is one of the weird things about the Slenderman, is that you can actually find numerous synchronicities concerning the Slenderman in the real world. I mean, a good example, is that in the early 1920s, bear in mind, you know, this is actually what I'm going to talk about now actually occurred in Waukesha, Wisconsin, where the two girls attacked their friend. Back in the early 1920s, in Waukesha, this little town, the body of a young boy was found drowned in a pond. And it was clear that he'd been murdered because he had sort of, you know, severe damage to his head and body and so on. And the little boy's identity was never identified. It still hasn't been identified to this day. But he became known as Little Lord Fauntleroy. And this was basically after the story of the same name. And he was given this name because the clothes that he was wearing when his body was found were very expensive clothes, suggesting he came from a very upper-class family. What's intriguing in this tragic story is that a psychic actually tried to figure out who the killer was, and she described him as a tall, thin man dressed in a black suit and carrying the boy through the woods. Now, this was 1921. You know, this was almost a century before the attack on the girl in Waukesha in 2014. It was just literally a couple of miles where the body of the boy was found, and, you know, you had the psychic involved. As I said, that was very near. Now, another kind of synchronistic angle, one of the people I interviewed for the book was a paranormal researcher named Mike Huberty. And Mike had an experience in 1994, again, just a couple of miles from where the girls attacked their friend. And Mike saw this tall, thin, shadowy figure in the woods. And he talked, the important thing is he talked about this before, the Slenderman phenomenon began. And so you have one of the more disturbing synchronistic angles, which I doubt even the police knew about this when they looked into it. You know, they were just focusing on the case. But you can find four or five weird stories all around Waukesha which go back to the early 1920s of attacks on children and sightings of large, thin, tall, thin figures all within 3 to 4 miles of where the attack occurred in 2014.
All right, now that's chilling, right? Mm. Does that mean that this creature has always existed, but wills itself back into existence every couple of years, almost like the It character again, right? Here you've got this every 27 years, this creature from the movie It resurfaces to feed off of the living, and and kind of re-energize itself before it goes back into a hibernation or slumber period. It seems that this being has that same ability. And when we were looking back at this, one of the things we found after the attacks is that, doing our show, we kept questioning, has this been reawakened? And we started finding that there were similar creatures like this that date back even, I think we, wasn't it around like Egyptian times or something, Tim, we found in the original deal?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
That there were iterations of this kind of creature that have been talked about or witnessed or part of legend and lore going all the way back. Were you able to find and substantiate any of those claims, or were these more misdirections by internet meme artists and fan fiction authors?
Well, I mean, that's a good question, Dave, because admittedly there have been some cases where fictional stories were interpreted as fact and people looked into them. They found that it was, it wasn't hoax and it was just people following on from, other people creating these entertaining stories as they saw them. But you're right, there are actually some classic examples. For example, David Weatherly, who wrote, the definitive book on the Black-Eyed Children. David very generously shared with me several cases that he got from in his files on the Slender Man sightings. They went back literally decades. But if you go back even further than that, you have like the story of the Pied Piper of Hamelin, which everybody's heard the story. Hamelin in Germany, the little town is over infested and overrun with rats, and this strange character comes into town and offers to get rid of all the rats. And he does so by playing this pipe and leading all the rats to the local river, and they drown. And then the mayor of Hamelin refuses to pay. So then the Pied Piper decides to, hit back in the worst case possible. And what he does, he plays this sort of hypnotic flute, and it entrances all the children in the town. And while all the adults are in the church, he plays his flute, and all the children playing in the street are hypnotized by the music, and they follow him into this, what is described as like a, almost like a portal in a mountain, and they vanish, and then they're not seen again. Now, the Pied Piper in one of the original stories was described as this tall, thin, menacing-looking character. And what does he do? He entrances children and takes them away with him into a mountainous location, which is surrounded by forest, which sounds just like the Slender Man. And if you read, the Pied Piper Hamelin, it's, essentially like a fairy tale for kids, but it's actually like a really sinister, disturbing story of child abduction. That's the only way you can describe it. But the character is very much like the Slender Man. So I think, this angle that several of the interviewees brought to me, that we're dealing with an ancient archetype which surfaces now and again, possibly because when people think about it, it re-energizes it. And so the more we think about it, the more we talk about it, the more publicity it gets, the stronger the tulpa gets. And so you have this spiraling situation.
And I'm having a Mandela effect moment. For our listeners, you just heard Nick telling you the story of the Pied Piper of Hamelin. I'm not going to say what it is right now. I'll tell Tim this off air so that he can take notes of this, and we'll maybe even videotape it right, after this show's over, so that we have it and we'll drop it. But how do you remember the story? What was the original story called? If you have a different recollection of the Pied Piper of Hamelin, email me, dave@darknessradio.com. That's dave@darknessradio.com. We'll cover that on a future episode. Do you have any idea what I'm referring to, Nick, or no?
No, I actually don't. I mean, the story itself, we can prove, it goes back.
Oh, no. It's not that. I'm not questioning that. The story is it. But the Mandela effect, correct?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Right. There's something, as soon as you started to tell the story, there's something glaringly different about your story than what I've always known, and I've read the story, and I've followed the story before, and it's a major change for me. While you were talking, I'm like, he's wrong, and I went and looked it up, and you're not wrong. My memory My Mandela effect memory is what's being affected. So that's why I want others to write into me. What do you remember of the story, the Pied Piper of Hamelin? And let me know what you think. Dave@darknessradio.com. I don't mean to jump a track here, but I always, when I'm confronted with a moment of Mandela effect, I love to see and put people to the test. And don't post it on my Facebook. Yeah. Just send me an email.
Yeah, I mean, the whole Mandela thing, I mean, that's sort of a fascinating phenomenon because, you know, it sort of gets to the heart of, well, I remember this, you know, this was real, I remember it. And then you look into something and then you think, well, maybe, why don't I remember it as it was? Or why wasn't it as I remember it? And that kind of really gets to the heart of, well, hang on a minute, you know, the reality I think I remember actually wasn't real, you know, and so it gets into some really weird areas.
Yeah, it does. And I'm sorry to kind of jump that track on you, but one of the rare instances that I would have sworn to you on my life that it's something different than what you just said. Mm-hmm. And we'll just leave it at that. So I'm not going to say specifically because I don't want to put it in the people's minds. I want people to respond to me separately and not in a public forum what they remember. And we'll go from there. Anyway, getting back into this. I've mentioned this in effect, and you just covered it so beautifully when you talked about, is it this ancient archetype that exists and gloms onto something? And I've told people this over and over. For a campy horror movie, it exactly exemplifies this story. It was Wes Craven's New Nightmare. Did you see that movie at all, Nick, or no?
I don't think I did see that one.
It's probably one of my favorites, aside from the very first Nightmare on Elm Street, because I thought it was so inventive. But here we are all these years later talking about this in the same form. And I've mentioned it, and I know a lot of our listeners know this, but for those of you that are new, what was so interesting about the story of Wes Craven's New Nightmare is it takes place in quote-unquote the real world. Wes Craven plays Wes Craven. Robert Englund plays Robert Englund. Heather Langenkamp from the original, who played Nancy, I think it was, is back as Heather Langenkamp. And they're put in a fictional setting, of course, but the whole idea is that they've ended the Nightmare on Elm Street series. And now each one of them is being plagued by this horrific vision of a darker, creepy Freddy. And it turns out that this evil has always existed. And from time to time, it gloms onto something, and it loved the fear and the energy that people gave to Freddy Krueger, so it fed off of that. And now that they've killed the series, it pissed it off, and now it's coming back at the creators. And it's going after the original cast members of the movie, and Wes Craven, who during the deal is typing a new movie. And when Heather Langenkamp goes to visit him, she looks at the computer screen, and it, like, where he's at is where she's standing in his living room having the same conversation with him. So it was really kind of a neat deal. But here, that's the idea. This ancient evil that always, this ancient beast or creature always existed, but it needs something to attach to continue to live. And it attached itself to Freddy, or attached itself to Slenderman. It's attached itself to something that will continue to live on and feed on. And that's why I wonder how many times this thing has evolved through history and different religions and cultures that have talked about the same kind of creature and being, especially with the spider-like legs that come out of its back. We found that in a few different cultures as we've read about some of these very similar creatures.
Well, yeah, and I think, I mean, a couple of good examples. I mean, there's one sort of school of thought that thinks the Men in Black are, you know, tulpas. You know, they don't seem to be fully self-aware, and they, you know, they have this strange way of talking, and they don't seem like, I mean, they're nothing like the movie versions at all. You know, they're sort of far more paranormal based. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if many of today's black-eyed children stories are driven by tulpas, you know, by the black-eyed children. Now, again, I don't dispute that there were original, legitimate reports, and the reports today are still legitimate, but we might be looking at two things: a genuine phenomenon of the black-eyed children, but then which, again, gets so many people fixated and interested and fascinated by it, that then you have a second form of the black-eyed children in the form of tulpas, which gets then really, it's really kind of confusing when you've got potentially two or more versions, so to speak, of one phenomenon.
Right. And what is it that we're really dealing with? What are these beings? What are these energy forms? And are we giving them life? Did this become, you know, was this, let's face it, this fits right in that category of an urban legend that many people told to dissuade children because wolves or wildcats or whatever lived in the woods and you didn't want your kids playing out there because there might be danger. So did this originate as a fable told by families to protect their children? You don't want to go in the woods, especially at night, because that's where, you know, Slender lives, or that's where this creature lives. And, you know, and we gave power to it. We gave fear to it. We gave energy to it. Did that create something that has continued to live on? Because it is, another one of the warning stories, right?
Oh, it is. And I mean, it's one of these things, you know, like, be careful what you ask for, you know, because right. You might get it. And I think what a lot of this demonstrates is the sheer collective power of the human mind, what it can achieve. But more dangerously, it can achieve this unknowingly. You know, it's not like the tens of thousands of kids who are fascinated by the Slender Man are trying to create it in their minds. You know, they're not sort of getting in an altered state and, you know, essentially meditating to try and call it forth. They're just all thinking about it. You know, it's like a different angle. But just that sheer process of so many incredible numbers, vast numbers of people thinking about it and focusing on the image of the black suit and the faceless face and the rubbery tentacles coming out of its back. You put all that together, that mind power, and then the reality, the stark reality, is that we're creating things which then have independent existence, and even though we're the creators, it's almost impossible to destroy them. You know, it's, you create something and you cannot put it back in, you know, in the box, so to speak.
Much like the Philip experiment that took place, right? Here they designed the experiment, they created, they gave a name and a backstory to this being, and then it started to communicate with others. Bill yep. Murphy, who I had on Coast to Coast AM with me that night, we were talking about the Pearl experiment that he was doing out at the Glen Tavern Inn in California. He created a ghost and a ghost story and a backstory. And now people are sending him, without knowing that he had created this, people sent him photographs of this woman's spirit that matches identically to the story that he created. Did he set in motion, or did he recall psychically the person that he said, and he only thought he created it? I mean, that's where the whole chicken and the egg thing in that kind of case, right? Did yeah. And that's kind of a fascinating angle to the whole story.
Yeah. Well, a more up-to-date version of this, which, again, you know, we're also kind of, you know, links with people are into sort of fantasy novels and comic books, that kind of thing, is one of the stories I talk about in the book of Alan Moore. Alan Moore, for people who don't know, is a British comic book writer and artist, and he created, of the many he created, perhaps the two most famous, one was the comic book series which turned into a movie, V for Vendetta, wrote that, and the other one being Constantine, which was turned into a movie with Keanu Reeves. Now, Alan Moore has gone on record as saying that, you know, he worked hard in his mind to sort of create the image of Constantine, this sort of demon-killing assassin, so to speak. And he came up with this image of how he would look and how his hair would look, his face, you know, his clothing, etc., etc. And really sort of, you know, focused deeply because he wanted to get this exactly right, you know, create the definitive character of Constantine. And Alan Moore said that one day, shortly after having sort of really worked hard and created this image in his mind, he was having lunch in a restaurant just off the River Thames in London, England, and he said he saw coming towards him the Constantine figure. the exact appearance that Mord envisaged, you know, in his artwork for his own original rough artwork for what, you know, we fleshed out to the comic books. And he said that as this Constantine character came towards him, he kind of gave Alan Moore this sort of sly, knowing grin and then vanished. And Moore was, like, freaked out and still is by this, to this day. He's very disturbed by the fact that, you know, he created the Constantine character and then he walked right past him with this sort of eerie grin in London, you know. So, again, it's an example. And of course, Alan Moore is a chaos magician, and chaos magic is based around sort of using fictional entities as a means to try and create a real-world version. So, again, it's sort of be careful of what you inadvertently ask for, because we can achieve things, and we do achieve things, and it's out of our control. You know, that's the problem.
Right, putting out to the universe imagery. People call it the secret or intention or manifestation, whatever you want to do. And how many times have you seen it? You know, and they've said creative visualization as well. Sports teams do this. Imagine or see yourself scoring that touchdown. See yourself celebrating after that touchdown. Don't worry about the rest. Just see the end result, and your mind will figure out a way to get you there. And you start to create or manifest destiny, create where you're going to be. So we are a powerful being. That's why I think a lot of people need to give themselves more credit where it comes to parts of the paranormal. What are we really experiencing in some cases? Is it something that is truly outside of us, or is it something that resides within us and we're giving it life? We're breathing life into it. We are our own gods for these beings, for these memories, these thoughts. And that may be why some people are so plagued by negative thoughts and you know, connotations, is because that's where their mind goes and that's how they focus. And that's why they are in that downward spiral of depression. It's because that's where they spend most of their time.
Yeah, but that's actually a good point, Dave, because, you know, the idea that perhaps so many, maybe the vast majority of weird things that are seen are, you know, the results of the collective belief systems of various people from various eras. I mean, if you look at the UFO phenomenon, totally different subject, but if you look from when the latter part of the 19th century, when the UFO subject really began with the so-called phantom airships people saw, we've seen a complete transformation in the phenomenon. I'll explain what I mean by that. In the late 1890s, you had the airships, which were a little bit advanced of, you know, what we were flying at the time with, mm-hmm. you know, rudimentary balloons and things like that. Then in the 40s, in the Second World War, you had these balls of light that became known as the Foo Fighters, which is where the band got their name from. Then in 1946, you had the ghost rockets over Scandinavia. 1947 had flying saucers. Today, people see these large flying triangle-type craft. It's like the phenomenon has improved and changed itself almost like a reflection to our technology that we have today. You know, the black flying triangles that people talk about seeing look like a next-generation stealth aircraft. The airships in the 1900s kind of looked like a next-generation version of our balloons. So, you know, you could make a case that we are creating so many of these mysteries, and then they become real mysteries because they have independent lives. And
we discussed this.
Yeah,
we discussed this bits of this with Dr. Michio Kaku back on our Tuesday show, with the idea that, you know, how what we perceive starts to become a reality. Is that something that can occur? And to that knowledge, remember, a lot of people that were experiencing quote-unquote aliens, they looked like us, the Nordics and some of the others, right? And it wasn't until the advent of Close Encounters and Whitley Strieber's Communion that suddenly this frog-like, big-eyed, bulbous head grade became kind of the status quo for what alien encounters look like. Then that was kind of the new version of how aliens appeared to us.
Yeah, and people rarely see those sort of long-haired, very human-looking aliens today. And I think, you know, that and that kind of ties in what we said about, you know, fairies and things like goblins and gnomes and pixies. You know, today we laugh at things like that, but for people 600 years ago, they were very real. But they kind of, they fragmented, and I won't say they're gone. You do get reports now and again, but for the most part, when you, people don't believe in them, they start to go away and they fade away until there's this sudden rush, and they're in vogue again, and people start to see them even more. So I think, you know, we can make a good case that the Slender Man has come to life in that fashion. But I think it's important to note that although the Slender Man by name and the literal vision of it was the work of Eric Knudsen, but if we've got an ancient archetype in the human subconscious, you know, that creates all around the world kind of a boogeyman figure, it doesn't matter, you know, if you live in the US, the UK, Russia, anywhere, you'll find these stories. And I think all it needs is the archetype to have a little bit more of like a, you know, igniting the flame, so to speak, and before you know it, more people are seeing it. Somebody's blogging about it. Somebody else is doing a podcast. Somebody decides to write a book. And before you know it, it's spiraling out of control. I mean, literally out of control, you know, out of our control.
Nick, how does Eric feel now? I mean, there was that spate right around the same time as those little girls attacked their friend. There were a few other cases that appeared in the news with a man trying to burn down his house and kill his mother, and he was an adult man because of Slender Man. There were a few other attacks that took place almost simultaneously and without knowledge of each other doing these type of things. Has Eric ever weighed in on his sense of responsibility, or, you know, and I'm not trying to pin anything on him, but has he ever weighed in on any of that?
Well, I mean, personally, I don't think, you know, I don't think we can put any blame on Eric Knudsen for what happened at all. I mean, he certainly expressed, you know, his deep sadness about what had happened, you know, deep regret about what had happened to the girl who got stabbed.
Right, and just for clarity, I wasn't trying to say it was his fault. I just want our listeners to know that. I just meant, you know, if I created something, you know, the fat man with this background and this storyline, and then people started killing or trying to kill in that vein, you know, I don't know how that guilt would affect me. And I just wondered if Eric ever addressed that. Does he regret, quote-unquote, creating Slender Man now?
I don't think he regrets creating it, but he certainly, you know, publicly, you can find on the, you know, on the news, on the internet, where, you know, he was deeply saddened by what had happened, you know, and as everyone was, I'm sure, you know, it's one of those unfortunate situations where, you know, whether the girls were, you know, influenced by the toll perversion or they just became obsessed by the phenomenon, you know, and they crossed the line in the worst case possible. You know, it's hard to say, but I mean, certainly Eric Knudsen, you know, it was, you know, expressed his deep, you know, sadness as to what had happened. But you know, I think the most important thing to note is that when all this occurs inadvertently, you know, and out of our hands, you know, essentially the creator, if you like, really only plays a small role in it. And when he does become sort of externalized, then it's a case of pretty much anything goes because it's starting to act independently then.
All right, Nick, the book is amazing, and it's a really great layout. And again, we've just barely scratched the surface. We will have a link to this story, to the book, if you go to darknessradio.com. And click on our Killer Deals link. You'll see the link to the Slender Man mystery, so you can order the book, get it for yourself. And again, do us a favor and Nick a favor. With this book or any of the books that you purchase from Amazon.com, please go on and rate those books. Because the more those books get rated, the higher ratings that you put out, the more publishers are going to see there is an issue and a demand for people that want more about these type of subjects. And great novels, great books, more things like this will continue to be made available. So go give Nick a 5-star review. Tell him that you heard about it on the Best in Paranormal Talk Radio with Beyond the Darkness. The book is fantastic. Give a great review and put that out there. Nick, the book's out. I want to ask you about this. Here you are helping to perpetuate this story and keep the information about Slender Man and the mysteries out there. Should we feel a concern, you and I, doing shows like this, writing books like this, that we may be continuing to keep this thing alive and give it more and more strength?
Well, that is one of the conflicts, you know, that sort of went through my mind when I was thinking about doing the book. I think it can be a genuine, real concern. But one of the things I do point out in the book is how the best ways to kind of deconstruct these things. So hopefully, you know, if people are interested in the phenomenon and they are concerned that, you know, in some way this has all been externalized in a supernatural fashion, that there are ways and means to deconstruct them, even though they've been created. So, you know, I hope that people would sort of pick up on that and realize the importance of not, yes, if you've got an interest, it's not going to go away, but don't be fixated and obsessed on it. You know, I think particularly in the world of the paranormal research, there's a fine line between having a deep interest and then something that tips over into an overwhelming obsession that basically takes a hold of a person's entire life. You know, they have no social life, they don't go out with their friends anymore, they just totally fixate on the paranormal, which isn't healthy. And I think if there's one thing we can learn more than anything else, is that it's, if you've got an interest in the Slender Man, that's one thing, but when it becomes an obsession, that, I think, is when we have this tip over into that, you know, into the other aspect then. And that's to what we should avoid, is becoming obsessed with the paranormal.
It's always great catching up with you, Nick. Thank you very much for writing the book, for being on the show, and for making a part of your book. I appreciate it more than you can imagine. It's always great to get those kind of surprises.
Oh, thanks, mate.
And somehow,
all right, thank you.
Just our discussion just fired off Tim and I, our computers on some kind of like Google alert or whatever. That was really bizarre. The Slender Man Mysteries, an internet urban legend, comes to life. Nick Redfern, and we'll put up links to Nick's website and information on our social media and on today's podcast. Thank you very much, Nick. Thank you all for tuning in. We'll be back again next week with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. Special thanks to Nick Redfern right here on Beyond the Darkness.
COTA just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your COTA fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with COTA. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
At CVS, it matters that we're not just in your community, but that we're part of it. It matters that we're here for you when you need us, day or night. And we want everyone to feel welcomed and rewarded. It matters that CVS is here to fill your prescriptions and here to fill your craving for a tasty and, yeah, healthy snack. At CVS, we're proud to serve your community because we believe where you get your medicine matters. So visit us at CVS.com or just come by our store. We can't wait to meet you. Store hours vary by location.